This is an ABC podcast.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
It was the 4th of April, 1968, just a few days before Easter. Democratic Senator Robert Kennedy announces the assassination of civil rights leader and Baptist preacher Martin Luther King Jr. I'm Andrew West. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. This week, a special program about the martyrdom 50 years ago of Dr. King. If you visit the Westminster Abbey in London, you'll walk beneath the statues of 10 martyrs of the 20th century, and most prominent is Dr. King. Since his death, liberals, conservatives, and radicals have laid claim to his legacy. And yes, he always tried to reach across the colour line, comforting those whites who feared black empowerment. But King also had a message, a very tough message, about the poverty and violence that propped up racism, and that made the powerful very uncomfortable. Today you'll hear two leading scholars of Dr. King and the civil rights movement. Theologian Anthea Butler is Chair of Religious and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. And Jonathan Ryder is the author of Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from a Birmingham Jail and the Struggle that Changed a Nation. Sometimes the lines to America are a bit scratchy, but they can't diminish the power of this drama. And Anthea Butler begins our story about the death of Martin Luther King.
He died for the rights of African Americans and others who have been abused by the governmental system of the United States. With Martin Luther King, faith is always interesting. There's belief there, obviously, but if we go back to look at his studies at Boston University and some of his beliefs, he wouldn't be the same kind of traditional Christian like we think he is. He's not like an evangelical who says, oh, I want to get saved. That's not Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King is about justice. He's about looking at the Old Testament God who is going to bring justice to the world. And so in that sense, I would say that maybe he died for his faith, but it's not just about the faith that he had, that the rights that were stated in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States should be extended to all people in the United States, and especially to African Americans who had suffered under the brunt of slavery and Jim Crow.
Jonathan, reflecting on what Anthea said there, it is important, though, to remember he did famously say, look, in the quiet recesses of my heart, I'm fundamentally a clergyman, a Baptist preacher. Would you say that his death fits the classic death of a martyr?
His view was an Afro-Christian, a very much version of Christianity and even of Jesus that the slaves forged, which was a very Old Testament understanding of Christianity, which means, as King says in Guidelines for Constructive Church, I've been anointed to deliver the captives. So the faith is there in his love of Jesus and his view of being a sacrificial enterprise, but it's in the interest of justice. I sacrifice my faith tells me that God doesn't like injustice in the world.
I mean, Anthea, would you characterize him as a prophet rather than a martyr?
Absolutely. I would say prophet first, especially probably at the end, maybe. Yes, he's a martyr because he decides to start going after the Vietnam War and poverty, which makes things a lot more difficult for him. And in one sense, you could think of him as a martyr because he's this big figure. But I would say he's definitely a prophetic figure. He is a prophet. Mm-hmm. And we know that prophets are without honor in their own countries.
And John, he derived so much from the story of Exodus, the biblical story, an Old Testament Jewish story, didn't he?
Well, he did, but he was following very much in the lineage of the slaves who Africans denied their own religion and own stories, forced into St. Paul epistles on obedience, could see in the Israelites down in Egypt a reflection of their own self. And so that deliverance theme always loomed large, not just in King's Christianity, but his mentor's Christianity. So I think that's really critical to understand that it's a black twist on Christianity that, of course, then finds an affinity in liberal Protestantism that says, don't just worry about wearing robes and heaven, but people suffering here in this earth, down here in this life. And so I think, again, this notion, he's a prophet, and the people who were closest to him, C.T. Vivian, Reverend Vivian once said to me, he said, look, I think he was a modern prophet.
Do you both think there have been attempts to purely secularize Dr. King?
Let me put it this way. I would say there have been attempts to secularize Dr. King and turn Dr. King into Santa Claus. They've tried to make him a very happy figure who went after civil rights and tried to take away all the very hard prophetic things that he had to say about America and the lack of civil rights for African Americans in this country. So when I hear Republicans and other conservatives talk about Dr. Martin Luther King, they sort of quote a couple of things from the I Have a Dream speech, and then they forget everything else he said. And so I think part of what we're fighting against, as scholars at least, is to recapture that stridency and the fierce urgency of now of Dr. King's voice at a time when we realize that civil rights have not had the progression that they need to have in the United States.
Yeah, well, we're not going to forget the other things he said. Jonathan, that obviously resonates with you too, that because, yeah, there was an attempt essentially to make Dr. King more comfortable to white ears, wasn't there?
There was, or in retrospect, to create him in this shriekly, tepid Santa Claus fashion. A shout out to Anthony on that. I think that's exactly right. But when you look at King, he was very different when he was before black audiences, where I spent more than a decade extracting the King who was in black churches and mass meetings, and then the crossover King talking to whites. And here's what we missed. That even when he's addressing whites, even the dream, the prophet is there in the shadows. The dream is not a comforting, kind of reassuring notion if you hear it in the way the King intended it. I have a dream that I will live, my children will live in a land where they will be judged by the content of the character. That's more radical than Colin Kaepernick. He's saying that country doesn't exist yet, and it won't exist until the civil rights, meaning black people, make that country.
Jonathan, there was a great moment of moral and religious clarity for Dr. King in 1956. Can you recall it for us?
It's that kitchen table moment, which is as close as one gets. I don't think King technically had a born-again experience, but early on in the Montgomery boycott, he's been chosen. Remember, he went back to Montgomery not intending to be a civil rights leader, and he was sort of pressed into service of the movement. And there he is, and he's leading, and he's being threatened by white racists who are phoning him in the middle of the night. They're going to kill him and blow him up and kill his children and wife. And he sinks down into a terrible panic and depression, and he goes down to the kitchen, and he bows his head, and he says, oh, you know, I couldn't call daddy. The language when he tells about this moment is very telling. He becomes the child because mom and daddy is down, you know, is over in Atlanta. And he said, and I discovered religion in a way it became real to me. And what he says, I discovered that God that my daddy told me who would make a way out of no way. And suddenly the Holy Spirit filled him because God promised never to leave me. And what's important there, because that comes back maybe a dozen times over the course of his career, he shares it for white audiences as well as black audiences, he's learning the way in which that faith that God will make a way out of no way and God will protect you allows him to go on despite the fear of death. And so as a young man, he's learning to live with death.
And yet, Anthea, in the face of all these threats of violence, Dr. King repeatedly spoke of something called the beloved community. What did he mean by the idea of the beloved community?
A community that would basically, and I'll let Jonathan expand on this, thinking about how we can all be together in love and have peace and not have to go through all of these things that people were going through at the time. This idea of the beloved community came out of part of his study. We've been talking a lot about his Christianity, but I feel like I need to bring up one more thing here that really is important. We need to think about how he looked to Eastern philosophy and Satyagraha and Hindu philosophy and thinking about what Gandhi was doing during this time period. He puts together kind of a really interesting I wouldn't say it's a pastiche, but I would say that it is a stream of beliefs that pull on Christianity, nonviolent struggle, to create that beloved community. You can't simply think about him as just espousing Christian ideals. He's pulling some of this because some of his mentors were looking at Gandhi while he's in university and in seminary.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report, Andrew West with you, this special program celebrating the life but also remembering the martyrdom some 50 years ago of Martin Luther King Jr. Our guests, two eminent King scholars, Anthea Butler, Chair of Religious Studies and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and Jonathan Ryder, author of Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from the Birmingham jail and the struggle that changed a nation. I want to spend the rest of this conversation focusing, I guess, on some of the frustrations and even, if you like, the shattered dreams that seem to come after what we all think of were the great victories, the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act that ended legal segregation. But Anthea, in 1967, Dr. King made a speech to a club in Atlanta where he spoke about the three evils of this world. What did he say in that speech, Anthea?
Well, basically, he talked about the poverty, war, suffering. I think for King, these evils are part of what he considered to be a continued system of degradation and violence in America. Part of what we're faced with, at least for King in 67, if you think about when he starts the Poor People's Campaign in December of 67, poverty is a very big issue in America. And that's an issue that was transcended not just African Americans, but whites and others as well. The escalation of the Vietnam War was a very big issue. And even though you might have had the passing of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, that did not mean that violence stopped. For King, what the press was, especially during 67 and leading up into 68, was a sense in which we may have made some progress, but we have not made full progress.
Jonathan, how did the establishment, and I guess the population generally, respond to Dr. King's efforts to broaden this movement, to tackle not just the continuing evil of racism, but also poverty and the Vietnam War?
The Washington Post and the New York Times, those august venues of liberal cosmopolitanism, decried what he was doing. There were establishment figures who said, "You have no gratitude to Lyndon Johnson." He was being roundly criticized also by black folks for saying, "Don't make Lyndon Johnson angry by talking about the Vietnam War, stick to civil rights." And so King, in this period, feeling pressed in on all sides, have we lost the market, in a sense, for nonviolence? Young blacks are throwing away the idea of nonviolence and turning to other forms. It's a very tough position for him, but you see in that Vietnam speech, of course, King says, "Listen, I am a minister of the gospel of Christ before I am a civil rights leader." And he's staking out a very radical claim. It's the prophetic endeavor that I've been anointed to help Vietnamese who are being burned by napalm, and to help the hungry, and to help the economically deprived, whether black or white. And he's in Marks, Mississippi at one point, and he sees black children, their stomachs distended with hunger, and he said, "God doesn't like that." The angry prophet, the indignant prophet, because it's not just anger, it's moral anger. It's, "This is wrong, and I need to speak. We cannot afford silence."
In that speech in Atlanta, he implied that part of what may have helped white acceptance of civil rights legislation was that it was basically free of any financial cost. But the next phase was going to be very costly, Anthea. Do you think that next phase, the Poor People's Campaign, which Martin Luther King said would cost billions, was actually even more frightening to his rather erstwhile allies?
Well, yeah, I do think that was more frightening. You can see the ways in which people responded to that. I mean, what King wanted to do is to get things better for housing, for instance. And when he went to Chicago for that, he ended up being beat back and stoned, basically, by protesters. You know, it's one thing to do the moral thing that's correct. The next time you try to put the moral issue alongside an economic issue, especially in America, this always becomes the troubling moment, right? Because people don't want to pay. They don't want to pay reparations. They don't want to make things equal. They are satisfied with things being unequal as long as there's not a financial cost for it.
Jonathan, in that 67 speech, he hearkened back to, again, a shattered promise that went all the way back to the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863. What did he say there? How did he link the two together?
This actually emerges, if you listen to King's preaching and exhorting in mass meetings in the final 6 months of his life, really the last year. The recordings are unbelievable. He's reminding people, they promised us 40 acres and a mule, and we never got that. And it's like letting a man, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, but you don't give them a boot. King's economic analysis was always there from the beginning, but it comes foremost as things develop. And he says very clearly, when he's thinking about reparations, he makes a really interesting idea. He said, look, we have a moral right to reparations. We are owed this. And he calculates in a very rough way what black people are owed. And then he makes a tremendously progressive move. He says we should think of white working class Southerners as derivative victims of racism, and they deserve reparations too. He's constantly thinking about economic fairness and equality in the most gracious, unbelievable way. And this becomes intensified. And I think we're seeing something about America. America has always been better at dealing with issues of membership, whether it's gay marriage or formal equality for African Americans, than the economic inequality and what that would entail.
It's the Religion and Ethics Report, a special program this week dealing with the 50th anniversary of the assassination and martyrdom of Dr. Martin Luther King. Our guests, Anthea Butler, a theologian and historian, and Jonathan Ryder, author of The Gospel of Freedom. In his final speech in Memphis, Tennessee, he's there to support 1,300 striking garbage workers. But he manages to encapsulate a lot of themes, and one of them is about nonviolence, and it's extremely powerful.
Men for years now have been talking about war and peace, but now no longer can they just talk about it. It is no longer the choice between violence and nonviolence in this world. It's nonviolence or non-existence. That is where we are today.
Anthea, it's nonviolence or non-existence. That is a statement of enormous moral power, but it's also a statement of common sense. Who would have been offended by that or challenged by that?
Probably the leadership of Memphis, a city, who didn't want to give the garbage workers any more money, were probably challenged by that. They were very upset about the strike. And so I think in a sense that people in power did not think that that applied to them. Anyone who understood King could hear that and say, yes, that makes perfectly good sense. But for those in power who King was coming up against, especially in Memphis, those words fell on deaf ears. They wanted to meet this garbage strike with violence, and they did. And we also forget what happened at that garbage strike. Why was King there in the first place? Two men had died picking up the trash. One had been crushed. The signs that you see from the pictures of the march in Memphis that said, I am a man, was a reminder that it was not just about African-American men saying that they were men, but that recognized the humanity of the people who were protesting, recognized that we need to be paid a living working wage, recognize that we pick up your trash every day, and recognize that you can't keep allowing us to die while we're picking up your waste.
One of the most beautiful parts of the speech is where he criticizes the city government for going to court to try to use legal injunctions to stop the march.
Somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
Every time I hear that, and ever since YouTube came along, I've been listening to this speech at Easter time every year. I am choked up by that. Jonathan, that reference, somewhere I read about the greatness of America, to me it seems to suggest that in spite of all the travails, of all the challenges, of all the frustrations, Dr. King, on the eve of his death, was still invested in the American dream. Was he or not?
Well, I think that King had an unbelievably exquisite sense of the hypocrisy of those who spout ideals of America as a redeemer nation, and the contradiction that slavery, the sin of slavery, presents. So some of this was his very crafty diplomacy. He didn't really use the dream metaphor as often as you would think. He used it regularly. But primarily, when he talks about the dream in black churches, he often talks that slaves had a dream that came even before it, that they would be free. And so King uses the American dream at the March on Washington. Notice that he is in what I call the prophetic future. I have a dream that one day. The dream is used as a moral battering ram that sheds the chasm between the reality of democracy in America.
Let's end by discussing the idea that animated this speech. I've been to the promised land. We're talking here about the speech before he died. That was a biblical allusion to perhaps the most powerful part of Dr. King's life. His public life, though, was actually bookended by that reference to the promised land. When did he first use that, Jonathan?
He uses that from his earliest preaching on, but when he's actually preaching on an average Sunday sermon at Dexter and then in Ebenezer, Exodus is really not as central as the story of Christ and the resurrection and the crucifixion. The Exodus makes a special sense in the mass meetings, because what is Exodus? It's a story of secular revolution, of people in bondage who are taking control of their life. So it is a constant in King, but it is more accentuated when he's in the mass meeting mode than in an average church sermon. But what does he say when he's really unhappy that only 5% of the churches in Birmingham in 1963 are supporting their movement? And he's very critical of black people. The black people don't want to free themselves. And he's back at Ebenezer preaching that he's taken a few days back in Atlanta. And he tells the story as in God's voice. And he imagines Moses coming to God and saying, the Israelite, the children of Israel, they're grumbling, they're whining. They want you to take them to the promised land. And King says, in the voice of God, tell the children of Israel to go forward. I can't do it all myself. And that's the existential dimension of King, that the oppressed are the only ones who can free themselves. And so Exodus, in that final speech, if you notice, some of it is about him and his anticipating death and preparing for death, but he's also reminding those sanitation men and the people who are struggling that you are responsible to free yourselves and keep on going, because the promised land will follow Egyptian bondage, just as the Lord will make a way out of no way, my God is able, and the resurrection follows the crucifixion. These are like deductive certainties that create balm in Gilead. There is hope, therefore you can free yourself if you struggle and keep on struggling.
Well, let's hear the final prophetic words of this man who died just 39 years of age.
Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Well, that was on the 3rd of April, 1968. Jonathan, just tell us what happened the next day.
Well, keep in mind that King has been in a terrible state for days, in a deep depression. He knows that he's being stalked by death squads. He's out of sorts and almost feels like he can't go to that mass meeting. There's thunder and there's lightning, but he manages to do this amazing thing when he seems to have a portent of his own death and, I think, acceptance of his own death, and gives an epitaph for the movement. I'm glad I didn't sneeze, because I wouldn't have been able to do all the things that we've been doing to free ourselves. And, of course, he goes to bed and gets up the next morning, and he's horsing around with Andrew Young, and his brother, I believe, is there, and various people are coming by, and the assassin takes him from us. What can you say? This is just the final dramatic moment to what he seems to know is in the works.
And Anthea, the great soul singer and jazz singer Nina Simone, who I think perhaps best summed up the fears of what would happen after the man she called the King of Love is dead.
Folks, you'd better stop and think, 'cause we're headed for the brink. What will happen now?
That he Well, what did happen? Dead. Because she said, you know, look, folks, you'd better stop and think.
Well, there was the break. I mean, you, from that point forward, you have riots, you have things that happen. People forget this 3 months later, basically. Bobby Kennedy is assassinated. America's cities are on fire all summer long. 68 is a watershed year in American history, and no doubt about it. You come through the Democratic Convention, that's, you know, riots in Chicago at the end of the summer. It's real chaos. And then you have the election of Richard Nixon. Don't forget that. It derails lots of things. But I also think it was something King himself knew was inevitable. He knew that he would probably be killed doing what he was doing. That did not stop him. And I think if he were here today, if he were able to comment, he would say that, well, we still haven't made it to that promised land yet. He may not have gotten there with us, but we certainly aren't there yet.
Well, I don't know where to take it from there, other than to say it's been an enormous privilege to speak with both of you. Professor Anthea Butler, who's Chair of Religious Studies and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and Anthea's latest book is Women in the Church of God in Christ. And she's the author of a forthcoming book on evangelicals and Donald Trump. And Professor Jonathan Ryder of Columbia University, author of The Gospel of Freedom, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Letter from a Birmingham Jail and the Struggle that Changed a Nation. I thank you both for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us. What a great crew.
And that is this special program for this week. Find us as always on the ABC Listen app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Muda Tadias, Wayne Ewan, and Hamish Camilleri. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.
What will happen now that he is dead?
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.